Welcome to Supercharge, the Change and Comms podcast. We've been delving into change and comms across the globe, and in this episode, we feature Tarnez Chelli, a true global change manager. Tarnez is loaded with change management credentials, and we're looking forward to hearing more about change and cultures in many of the countries that Tarnez has worked in. So welcome, Tarnez. It's so great to meet you.
Hi, Chris. How are you? Great to meet you too.
And Pete, as always, in Barcelona. Drought still on?
Yeah, it is raining though. So, you know, bit of water. It's always good here.
Bit of water. Makes you feel like you're back in Britain. It's raining and raining.
Yeah, I was working with people all across the UK yesterday and everybody was saying it was raining wherever they were in the UK. So glad to know everything's still normal back home. Tarnez, it's great to meet you. And what time is it where you are, just for our reference?
It's about 8:10 p.m.
Thank you for giving up your Friday evening to talk to us. So we wanted to start off by talking a little bit, because we were put in touch with you by Doug Flory, who we're doing an episode with, who's based in Utah in the USA. And I think, if I'm correct, that you would have met each other or worked with each other a bit through the Association of Change Management Professionals. First, I hope that's right, but I wondered if you could tell us a bit about what that is and what your experience has been with it.
Okay, before that, let me just tell you a little bit about me so that you know what is my background is going to be like. So I'm originated from Malaysia, in Asian country. We realize the country itself have the word Asia. And then what I do, I'm an advocate of change. And the goal of my work or my career is about bringing change to my country as well as Asian, because it's still at the very level where there's so much of opportunity. So this is what that I dive in and I really want to do it. Okay, so that's a little bit of my background. Now, ACMP is a great platform. Why? Simple reason, because it brings in people across the global, which creates a platform where you can actually share not only your knowledge, but basically your experience as well in terms of understanding people. That's the key, right? Now, I can be from Malaysia and imagine in a situation where I need to actually drive change in another country and I've no idea how is it going to be like. So this platform gives you the excellent opportunity to communicate with the experts around the world who actually there to share their knowledge in terms of what they do, how they do it, what are the methodologies they use. And additionally, it is the even more what I find important is the experience. And I can get knowledge anywhere. I mean, with this tech world today, I can just have to play with my fingers. I just have to key in anything and I'm there. There you go. And with AI, I think knowledge is not an issue. But what you may not find in AI is the experience, especially people experience. And that is the very, very essential for today's world, because without experience for you to drive change that involves people, it becomes very crucial. And so that's why I find ACMP has given me that kind of opportunity where I go in, you know, I can actually be myself. I can share my perspective from the Asian level. And additionally, one of the key things that I was working on when I was with ACMP was in terms of DEI. So DEI is very close to me, diversity, equity, inclusion. So that is something that I went deeper into it. And there was one part where I was leading a team in terms of creating a standard for DEI and what we should do in terms of popularizing it and making it something strong for people to apply and adapt to every organization. So that is something that I brought it back to my country, which I find that this is one thing that a country really needs. I mean, yes, change is important, but in order to actually make change successful, now DEI plays a very crucial role.
Yeah, I agree.
So for me, ACMP have given me that kind of opportunity where there's a lot of lessons. And there's a lot of, as I say, experience from people, which actually that has helped me in my career as well.
We were talking to Doug about the same thing. We were confused for a while because we call it EDI. So I thought it was something completely different. But so what was I going to say? How long have you been involved with ACMP, or how did that kind of start?
All right. I started in year 2021. So that was during the COVID years. That's when we all actually went into the remote. So that's when I started. And then I went on until last year. Then I took a short break and then I went back in as a council of advisor, as a passport of members. So I'm still there. And as and when I could contribute, yes, I do that. So that has been, as I said, that has actually given me a solid path, because can you imagine a scenario where you are in your country, but you're bringing the whole world to your country in terms of experience where people never heard about that? So that is the one thing that I find that it gives me an advantage, because I have that and I can share what other people are doing and where others may not have that opportunity to do so. So that makes me stand out.
Yes, it does. And Tanis, you said DEI, so diversity, equity and inclusion, plays a crucial role. What are the things that you've taken back to, you know, the organizations and the countries in which you work on that have come out of, you know, that broader understanding of DEI and change? What's the biggest interventions or, you know, cultural changes you've picked up and taken away?
The first step that I actually did is creating that awareness, what is DEI? Because many of them took it very lightly, because we know, like, for example, I came from a country where it's multicultural. So when you talk about diversity, yes, it's pretty common, you know, what is diversity means in terms of cultural terms. But what they fail to understand is what is the impact it has in the organization growth. So the first step that I took in terms of the organization when I work with multiple projects is that creating that awareness is that how much of impact that it has on your outcome when you're trying to deliver a project. Because if you don't actually focus on all those things, people who comes from a diverse area might feel that they are not actually playing importance in the role of the project or bringing out an outcome. So they feel that we are actually giving more attention to the project than the people who are impacted in the project. So that's when the change becomes difficult. So a small thing as creating awareness, and I realized that made an excellent difference, because people start recognizing it. And in every engagement, in every activity, in every communication, the thought of diversity was still running in their mind. So that made them be aware that, okay, I need to ensure that whatever I do, I need to bring that into that picture of my work. Now, same goes to equity. Now, when it comes to equity, again, you have this culture whereby they are different set of people from different culture and whether they're having the right amount of opportunity. So we think as long as you're an employee of the organization, we make the assumption that everyone gets an equal opportunity. But in the actual scenario, that doesn't work. So how do we actually measure that? How do we ensure that whatever we are doing, that people are actually getting an equal opportunity? So there have to be some level of measurement put in place so that at the end of the day, your action represents each and every individual in the organization, but not as a whole, as a group. I'm not calling it as, oh, every stakeholder is being considered, but I'm actually going to the very lowest level of the individual to ensure that they have a voice. So the voice becomes very important here.
I often find when I'm involved in a project that we might have something that we'd check, or it'd be like some kind of form that people have to fill in to say, yeah, have you considered equality, diversity? Have you considered the impact of it? Tick, tick, tick. But that even getting people to look at the form or engage with that is quite difficult. And that often, I don't know, I'm not sure what it is, but perhaps a project manager might think, oh, this project's not really going to have that kind of impact. We'll just carry on. That's for someone else to do. I'm ignoring that. I just wondered if those were the types of things that you saw as well, and if you had any tips on, on avoiding that or getting people to engage.
All right. I'm just going to share this. The method you use to actually measure this, you got to be careful, because in my country, the measurement of a survey is one of the worst methods. Nobody is going to give you a genuine answer. So if you're going to use the method of survey based on the country and based on the culture, if the method is not good, the outcome is not going to be good. So the method that I use is I ensure that I go down to the ground. For me, the ground zero is very important place. So when you go to the ground zero, you engage with the people, you make them feel every impacted individual are important. If they don't have that feeling, then eventually they are just a member in whatever deliverables that you're doing, but they are not a contributing member towards the deliverable. That's what I find, and that's what I'm working on, even with the current project that I'm doing. And I'm equally implying that because I want to ensure that every individual who is impacted with it, they truly understand what we are trying to do. Because at the end of the day, they're going to ask you just one question. You can do hundreds of projects, but what is it in for me? So now I need to bring that big project to a very tiny, tiny level, to the individual level, and tell them, this is why it's important for you. So this is where I need to bring them inside.
So in some very practical terms then, applying EDI into change management, you take it just to basically into the training, into the classroom. It's the interventions we apply to ensure those who are slightly neurodiverse or have a preferred training or communication style are considered just as part of your plan. It's a very simple step, right? You don't have to go into, you know, some great theoretical or dangerous territory around academia. It is just about making sure that the interventions we apply are considered about people who might learn differently or might communicate differently or might absorb information differently. That's a very simple starting point. Would you agree, Tanaz?
Absolutely, because you must understand that people are already complicated. Don't make things method become even more complicated. So I would love to apply a simple approach where it's easy to reach them and it's even more easier for them to understand it, for them to actually deliver something.
The business benefit to that then, Tanaz, is actually, you know, can lead to improved staff retention as much as it can do to increased engagement and buy into the company. There's the benefits of just considering these upfront and early. Don't just land directly to the individual, but it actually impacts the culture of the business.
Yes, absolutely right, Chris. You got it that right. Because though my approach is to every individual, but the unique value the organization is going to get is the one that I'm looking for. And this is where the organization actually progresses to a maturity level in terms of dealing with changes. If it's not at the very basic down level, then at the end of the day, if you won't see organization progressing, but what you will see is they keep on adding projects after projects, but the real change does not take place.
The thing around EI is people just assume it's about, like, you know, discussing whether it's a tick box exercise or whether or not, you know, the organization actually responds to these things because they can see the accumulation effect that occurs. It's the downstream benefits that come from getting it right very early that you sometimes would consider intangible because you wouldn't necessarily be able to draw them back in. But, you know, culturally, it makes a difference to attracting, you know, more people, better people, keeping the right people, and, you know, making future change stick.
Tanaz, I wondered if we could just talk a bit about your kind of experience delivering change. What, you know, what kind of projects or industries have you worked in? What kind of things have stood out for you in your career history, and what do you enjoy about change?
In terms of industry, I practically covered most of the industry, ranging from manufacturing, oil and gas industry, medical industries, you know, let me see, any kinds of business. I have had participants coming to the training from all perspectives in terms of the sectors. And why do I enjoy it? Okay. Can you imagine if you just go out to the street and you meet somebody and you start talking about a change? What do you think the reaction of the people is going to be? They're going to think that, what am I doing? What am I talking about? So training for me is like a trailer before you're watching the actual movie. You know, you get the bits and pieces of it. And then additionally, what training has given me an opportunity is, if you realize, it doesn't matter what kind of training that I'm doing, but whatever training that I'm doing, whether it's related to system improvement or competency and skills or leadership, everything involves a change. Simple as that. But they don't see that. The only thing they see is I'm attending a training and I'm gaining a particular skill. But they don't see the changes they have to go through. So this is where, when I meet that people, it gives me that opportunity to actually say that all the trainings are good, but what you need to do is just one more additional step. And that is the change that you got to manage in order to make sure your training becomes even more effective. So then suddenly they'll think about it. Oh, you mean I need to do one more step and then this will be good? Because most of the organization right now, biggest challenge they face is that they could not get an ROI out of a training. Because they learn, they go for 2 days training, 3 days training, but when they go back to the organization, they're asking a question, why is it people are not applying what they have learned? So this is the gap. the gap is we fail to manage the change that training is bringing to the organization. So that opportunity was given to me through the training why I opened their mind. It's just like opening a locked door. The door has been locked for many years. You know for the fact change is in your mind, but nobody has opened that door for many years. And they have the training key. You just go and unlock the door. You let them see how much of impact the change can make in everything that you do in the organization. So that's how powerful training has been in that sense.
So the bit that you mentioned about return on investment then for the company, yes. Do you see that as something that you can support or help with? And if so, how do you do that?
In terms of training?
Yeah.
All right. So what happens is like, again, the moment I've conducted a training and then I'll open it up, then it gives me a path to actually go and talk to the management. And this is where I'll bring them. Okay, let me show you how to make the training effectiveness and how to make sure that training eventually brings the ROI to you. And this is where I'll have another step where I create a coaching, you know, in terms of change, what you need to do. And then I'll create a plan for them. Okay, these are the things, that additional things that we need to do. So that it becomes an additional consultancy into that training part. So you come in, you give them the whole package. Look here. Excellent. You have opened the door. There are so many things behind the door. Now, right now, you want to arrange everything properly so that whatever was in the door is you can visualize and you can apply it. So this is what I do. I give them the training. I come in. I have the further conversation build up from the training so that they can see a bigger picture. And from there, I give them a strategy, what they can actually apply and then execute. And then this is where your ROI is going to be. So they see the whole process taking place. It's not only about training. I say, okay, I have gained knowledge, but what I'm going to do with the knowledge if I don't have the opportunity to apply it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Most organizations face this. They send many employees for training, but they fail to give an opportunity to apply what they have learned.
I've just drawn something based on what you said. And then as I drew it, you started kind of catching the points. And it's really important because you're right. Training is not the beginning. It's roughly the middle because you've got to do all the other stuff in the change first. You know, your change impact assessments, your training needs, your communications, all those good kind of therapy type things. When the program or project matures, the technical training can then be deployed. But that, like you say, is just the trailer. I love that. It's a great analogy. I'm going to use it. Because actually post-training, you have to give the time to apply that training. And that your ROI really doesn't even start then in my mind, because you're giving someone the time to apply and practice what they've been taught. We'll provide wraparound support through super users, drop-ins, all those good things. But then after that, that's when they become masters of what they're doing. And it's only when they become masters can they start actually showing the business benefit, the return on the investment, and the business benefit realization plans could come into default, and you could track and see against, you know, whatever products or services you try to improve, you'll see it. But not until the ability to practice has been taken. You can't just go from training to mastery. It's not going to happen. It wouldn't happen anywhere else. So why would we expect it in the workplace, in the training space? And it's in the application bit, well, the training and the application bit, where the DEI stuff becomes super important. Because if they haven't had the ability to participate, because we haven't put interventions that accept whatever their you know, learning requirements are, then we can't expect to see the benefit later on. Because they were never able to, you know, fully exploit the support and the training we gave them. It's a clear journey, isn't it?
Absolute summary, Chris. Thank you very much for summarizing that. Yes, you just got it out from my mind. That's exactly what I'm saying. And if you realize there's a lot of money is being invested in training, but and then they keep sending people for training, but they don't actually see what's supposed to happen after that.
What's the change management culture or maturity like in the job market there? Are there lots of change managers, or is it still something that's quite an evolving profession and you get people that are interested and think maybe this is something that I want to explore, but they're doing other jobs at the moment?
All right. Okay. To be very truthful, change management is still at the very infant level. So they do have titles as change managers, but their title, if you look at the job description, end up having project role instead of a change manager's role. So that's commonly what I see. Or it is more related to just doing communications. So they do not really understand that it goes beyond that, and it's a very powerful position they are holding. So they're not really taking that power yet. They have the title without a power to drive. That's what's currently happening. So this is where I actually build that scope, and I'll tell them, you are actually holding an excellent position. Now go and grab the power so that you can actually drive and make the world to change. So that's the excitement that I create. So now I do have the team that I'm developing right now who comes and asks me that, can I build my career over change management? And I say, absolutely. There are so many jobs, there are so many opportunities. And additionally, can you just think, what are the possible changes that you can actually bring to an organization? And your name is behind that change. That is that, you know, build, that is the part that actually drive them towards that.
I think it's hugely important as well, because when we were setting up the change management function at the university, one of the key things I insisted upon was that the change manager was not to be working for the project manager. The change manager discipline is its own thing. It has to have its own independent relationship with the sponsor or stakeholder, because otherwise you're never going to be able to tell the truth back into those who are your SROs or your senior sponsors, because they'll hear the view that project or the program manager will give, which is a very different scenario to the role we have. Project managers and programmers are very good at protecting their scope, and they'll protect the scope of what their program delivers, but the change management goes beyond the scope of the project or the program, because we have to ensure that they're ready to accept the project and the program. The project and program manager will not accept that the stuff that we have to do to get the business ready is within their scope. So we have to have a separate relationship. So you saying that is just like, yeah, on the money for me. Absolutely. Absolutely spot on.
Yeah. And I always have that kind of argument with the project managers, you know, where, you know, I keep telling them, you can do 100 projects a year, but if they are not ready to accept it, you can do another 100 for the following year.
That's exactly right. I was just going to say, Thomas, I'm looking at your LinkedIn. I do this when we go on all the pods, because I think actually you can get some really interesting points. But when we say that we've been talking to change managers across the world who've worked in different countries, you have actually worked in so many different countries from, and I'm reading these out, right, because I would never remember there's that many: Cambodia, Vietnam, Brunei, Hong Kong, Singapore, Indonesia, Muscat, Oman, and obviously Malaysia, where you're based. I mean, do you find, I mean, that's a list, isn't it? I mean, that's like my dream travel list, let alone the places you've been lucky enough to work. But have you, in those countries, do you notice a cultural difference in terms of how change management is applied, but also adopted?
All right. In those countries that I traveled, and then what I've realized is they apply change management unconsciously, not consciously. That's two different things. Eh? So I do things not realizing I'm actually driving the change, but I'm doing it as just an action. And since it's unconscious, people are not aware they need to produce a result. When the unconsciousness becomes conscious action, then the awareness increases, and then the result increases as well. So in those countries, right, what I realize is I've observed many cases where people want people to change. Okay, simple thing, what I want at the end of the day is I want every employee to be able to work and produce what I expect them to produce. Simple as that. It's a simple mathematic equation if you look at it. But what happens is, for that to achieve, there are so many challenges. There are so many struggles to reach the result they're expecting to. So they are actually doing many activities in order to achieve it. So they do not know those activities they are trying to engage with them is actually change management activities, but they are not conscious about it. So when they are not conscious about it, they don't even have the awareness, what is the outcome of the activities? So that's why you don't see them achieving the result, but they get tired of doing so many things in the process. And they keep asking themselves, I'm doing everything. Why is it not happening the way it's supposed to happen? So that's why, you know, sometimes you have that opportunity to jump in and say, I'm here, don't worry. I'm here to help, and let me do it.
I like those types of projects as well, because it's kind of like they're quite pleased to see you. They're quite pleased to just take some help and say, actually, yeah, just point us in a direction where perhaps we could just, you know, improve just maybe one or two small things to have a bigger output, because, you know, we've done this all, haven't we? We can't train and teach everything. So you just train and teach small things to make, you know, incremental improvements. So I do like that when that happens. It's quite the, I mean, I can't even imagine what going in and doing that in places like in Vietnam and Oman must be like. It must be quite a positive experience, but maybe quite challenging too.
Yeah, it's very challenging, because though you're talking about Cambodia and Vietnam, which is actually Asia. So when I went into the country, I was pretty comfortable thinking I'm an Asian, shouldn't be a problem. It'd be easy for me to actually manage this group of people. But no, okay, it does not happen that way. Every word that I spoke positively sound negative to them.
Why?
So that was the first shocking experience I had.
Okay.
The cultural difference. The cultural difference. Simple as that. Is the cultural differences. So one of the main things that I've realized that though I'm an Asian, I can't make this assumption every other Asian country is the same. That I can actually just go in, jump in and start doing what I've done it before in my own country. But I have to still start from the scratch where I need to understand who they are. I need to study a little bit of their culture. I need to study their lifestyle. Even lifestyle becomes a crucial, important thing for me. I need to know what I can say, what I cannot say in their culture. What are the words to use? So this is the first thing that I did. So I need to adapt the change first before I could actually drive it. But once I'm able to do that, and that became much easier for me. Because I start talking in their language, even though it's English, but in their terms. So you must understand, English is English, but the words in English represents different meaning based on different cultures. So that becomes crucial in change.
Definitely. I can say that for someone living in a different country and still using English, is the words that people use change. And you often reach, I think you sometimes you end up speaking a kind of compromise or international version of English where you, it's a third language completely and it means something else to anybody else that's listening to it. But
yeah,
I was wondering though, so because you said a bit about needing to adapt to the lifestyle and trying to understand, you know, what people's mindsets are and where they come from. How do you do that? Because it's quite difficult to do that on your own.
Oh, I do a lot of research. Now, I have this habit which I developed when I was young. So what I used to do is I just sit at one corner in a public area and I watch the behavior and pattern of people, you know, how they talk, you know, how they behave. And I realized that I can talk to you in one way and I'm the same person. I can talk to Chris in a different manner. Then I started analyzing that why people do that, because they are trying to create an impression, different impression to different two sets of people. So all those experience, right, gave me that skill where when I communicate with someone, the first thing is I look at their body language. Are they reacting to my words or they are not reacting to my words? You know, I observe their eyes, observe their hands, legs, movement. Any small movement will indicate to me the comfortability of them listening to what I say. So if I realize they are a little bit uncomfortable, now that gives me a trigger, change. Don't use this, use something else. So I've been doing that, trial and error. So every time I apply a method, then I'll write it down. I know I can use it somewhere else in a different project.
I can see that writing stuff down is probably one of your key strengths. I mean, you in your armory, you have more qualifications in this stuff than I think I've ever seen offered in a course catalogue. So you've got that theory so well versed that you're actually applying the same methods that you've used to learn, to actually learn how others are behaving to, you know, the materials and the change interventions you apply. It's I mean, it just, if you want to have a look at Tanner's LinkedIn, you'll see. I mean, that we have everything from ProSci, ITIL, MBAs, training, Lean Six Sigma. I mean, I'm just jealous.
I think we can put you on a few of those, Chris.
Yeah, you'd get a different person come out, I think.
I don't want to ask you what's your favorite qualification or your favorite certification, because I don't think that really means much, but perhaps you do have a favorite.
My favorite is ProSci certification, because I tell you why it became my favorite. The reason is I was in project for 14 years plus, and every time I'm in the project, I always had that emptiness in me saying that, okay, the project ended and I should be happy. But when I go down to the ground, people were not happy. So I keep asking myself, what is it that I'm not doing right? So that's when I came across ProSci, then I realized, oh gosh, there is a gap that I failed to close. So that became a point where it made the rest of my history more glaring. So whatever I had with ProSci, it became more glary. That helped me out. So that's why it became my favorite.
Well, ProSci offers a nice set of guardrails, doesn't it, in terms of a structure to follow. And it's using your other experiences that you can then deviate away depending on the audience and the culture that you're trying to, you know, engage on a journey. So I think that's what I really like ProSci. I find it really helpful. But I've often said found the best use of it is the ability to know when and which bits to use and not necessarily thinking you have to use everything.
That's absolutely right.
Just in terms of what we were talking about before, if Chris gets his dream job in, I don't know, let's say he gets his dream job in Malaysia, he's coming over there to manage change on a project. What would your top tips be for him to land it nicely? Assume he's done no research. Well, okay, he's written some stuff down, I can see. You know, he's just landed.
All right. First of all, I'm going to tell him, welcome to the land of opportunities. You have a lot of opportunities here. Okay. It's just waiting for you to grab it. That's it. Okay. So that is the first thing I'm going to welcome. Now, I have four key values that you must remember that when you are coming into Asian country. They're very simple values, but very strong values. Now, the first value that I want to actually talk about is for you to understand that a very common practice in most of the Asian countries is hierarchy style administration. So it's by ranking, it's by title. So the name, as you say, pronouncing my name should be rightful, right? But here, pronunciation of the right title even becomes very critical because that's my first encounter. So when I have a hierarchy system in place, then I must ensure that every level is identified according to their title, because those are the doors that you need to open in sequence. So if you do not know the hierarchy style, what will happen is you will go and open the wrong door in the wrong sequence where you will create a wrong impression, which is going to cost you a lot of struggle throughout the process. That's key number value one. Now, key value two. It's high tolerance. Why tolerance? Because things is going to be different than where you came from. So you would have certain kind of standards, perspective. So I would say, please come with the empty sheet, because this is where you're going to do a lot of coloring. You're going to do a lot of painting. So make the painting beautiful. But if your paper is already, there's a painting there, you can't add on anymore. So keep it empty. So have that eye tolerance level, because everything is going to come in at a certain pace, which may not be aligned with your kind of pace. So you got to add that. Now, third value, very, very important, acceptance, not judgmental. There's a very thin line between acceptance and judgmental. And so when I go and tell them, okay, the very first thing you must actually understand is the cultural differences. So people say, oh, no worries. I understand. I have studied it. I have done my research in terms of the culture. I'm very good at it, you know. So we tell them, okay, so you got to learn to accept it. But in the name of acceptance, they end up making a judgment out of it. So that could be very crucial. So very thin line between acceptance and judgment. Again, we are playing with words. So that's how we're going to be. So that comes to the falling point is sensitivity. Beliefs, cultural sensitivity. Now, just to give you a picture, when you talk about culture, right, let me give you the whole picture of culture. So you're going to a country. So level one is country culture, right? Level two is between urban and rural culture, right? Level three, organization culture, right? Level four, individual culture.
I really like that. Yeah.
So
that makes complete sense.
So that meant, right, so every approach that you are going to implement is based on the culture systems that you got to be aware of. So that's why I say that acceptance, but not judgmental. So you got to be very careful in that. And the final thing, which is very, very crucial, is respect. Very crucial. Now, this is what I have gone through it myself. Sometimes you think you know it all, or you think that you are an expert. And then you go into the organization, you want to do this, you want to do that. You know, you have so many ideas in place, you know, you're all geared up, you just want to implement something. But in that process, we forget to give the respect, the due respect to the stakeholders. Because for them, they feel that, hey, look here, I know my organization. I've been sitting here for years. I've been holding this title. I know what I'm doing. So especially in a hierarchy-based system, now respect becomes very, very crucial. So I want to make sure whatever that I do, I bring them up. I boost them up. So I put them in front of me instead of behind me. So that's the image I create.
You're giving me some useful tips for the UK,
I think.
So the other front
picture and the back picture.
Yeah, I think actually a lot of what you said there, Thanos, is very applicable to maybe even just changing a job in a new organization.
Yeah.
They're really good, just kind of sensible. It's a sensible mindset, isn't it? I think they're really applicable just to changing culture, definitely. And I love the observation in a public space that you referenced earlier. I could see how that can help with the sensitivities point you made. But even so, I think even if you were just to change it, from significant company to company or industry to industry, those things are actually, they're applicable to everything.
Yeah, but the only thing, what happens is that people forget that to fly.
Yes.
We need to wrap up because we've had a really good chat, actually, I think. And I'm really looking forward to going back through and listening to this because I'm sure there's a lot I can learn that I need to write down. Like Chris has been, I haven't got my pen and paper with me. There is one final question. It's kind of a cultural question, but we ask it to every guest and just it's always a surprise. And I have to apologize because when we've been speaking to people in the UK or Europe, this has made a lot more sense. But when we ask people, what is your favorite biscuit? Then sometimes we found recently people don't quite understand what biscuits are. I think our American friend thought they were something to put in gravy. So I'm interested to see how you answer the question anyway. So what is your favorite biscuit?
My favorite biscuit is butter cookies.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Butter cookies.
Yeah, we can go for those.
Now, believe me, I went to UK. I went to Harrods. The first thing that I grab is, what kind of butter cookies do you have? That's the very first thing I did, you know. So my basket was literally full of different type of butter cookies originating from different states and different countries.
That's amazing. And a good choice.
I'm happy with these.
That's a good choice because they go so well with tea or coffee.
Absolutely right.
Thanos, thank you for your time, especially as it's your Friday evening, your weekend, I assume. I've made a cultural assumption there, actually, because, of course, in Dubai, of course, the weekend isn't on a Friday, is it? It's a Sunday and a Monday, so I shouldn't have made that assumption. Anyway, thank you for giving up your Friday.
No worries, because I'm kind of used to the US time and UK time as well.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I do deal with people from there, so I'm pretty comfortable with this time.
Thank you so much for giving up your time to do this.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity as well. I really appreciate that.